Welcome to Mission Driven, a conversation about how startups leverage their social mission as competitive advantage. Mission Driven is hosted by Better Ventures, a seed stage venture fund in Oakland, California, backing entrepreneurs using science and technology to address the world's biggest challenges. You can find us on the web at better.vc and on Twitter at Better Ventures. Hi, Amy Francetic of Buoyant Ventures. Great to talk with you today.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Just great. I'm trying to remember how we originally connected, but I feel like I think I sent you an email about one of our companies like 10 years ago or something. And then,
and
we traded some email, and then you were just like a name, not a face. And then I was talking to someone late at night on a rooftop in San Francisco. And then I eventually realized that was you. So that's when I remember meeting you. That was quite a while back.
All great relationships start on a rooftop in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's funny. Actually, also, I just met your a business partner recently as well, Allison. We were in Chicago, and she arranged something on a rooptop at a rooptop bar.
Yes, so we got this theme, right?
There's something
we
like about to be rooftops,
outside.
Right?
We like to be outside. Yes, please.
All right, you hearing that?
We're avid outdoors people. Yes, we'd rather be outside than inside.
You hearing that, founders? Outside. Okay. So a lot of water under the dam since then. Do you want to just say a bit about your background? I think at that time you were either at Clean Energy Trust, which is now named something different, or founding a venture firm. You want to just maybe say a bit about background?
Sure. So I've been in the climate space for about 18 years. I like to say long before it was fashionable. Lived through the correction, the clean tech correction in 2007 to 2010, and have some learnings from that that have sort of influenced, you know, what we're doing today. But I started my career in consumer technology at Electronic Arts, and I spent 20 years in California. I'm now back in Chicago. So I live on the North Shore in Lake Forest, and we have an office in Chicago, and our headquarters for the fund is Chicago. But I spent 20 years in California, including my time at school. And then I ran a consumer technology company that we sold to Lego. And it was a high-tech toy company that Paul Allen, one of the co-founders of Microsoft, funded. And that was the year 2000. So,
what kind of toys were they?
We were taking physical toys for young kids and putting electronics in them and connecting them to the computer and using the toys to control the virtual experience. So it was kind of this, you know, tactile interaction with the virtual experience, a sort of a new mode of interacting with the computer, and Lego liked what we were doing and bought it and put it into the robotics line that they had for a number of years, which they no longer have because, of course, all the technology has evolved and, you know, so much since then. This was the year 2000. But then moved back to raise my kids after I had both my girls born at Stanford Hospital, moved back to the Midwest to raise them closer to my family, and spent my career here, you know, bringing our kids up in Lake Forest. And I have two daughters, 18 and 20, and spent, you know, my time here working in private equity, and then starting the Clean Energy Trust, which I ran for 7 years and now serve as chairperson of the board. And we renamed it Evergreen Climate Innovations. And we fund really early stage, deep tech, kind of hard science innovation in the climate space in the broader Midwest. And it has a unique structure. It's actually a nonprofit. So money comes in as grants, donations, and sponsorships, and goes out as equity investments. And returns that are generated are recycled and reinvested. So hence the name Evergreen, because it's an evergreen fund structure. And we funded 42 or 43 companies in 12 years. And then I started Energize Ventures with Michael Polsky and raised Fund 1, hired the team, oversaw investments. And the investment thesis there was digital energy and industrial automation, and parted ways with Energize at the end of 2019 to start Buoyant with Allison Myers. And so Buoyant launched formally in January of 2020. And our thesis is digital climate solutions. And so we're screening all of our investments at the top of the funnel for climate impact, either, you know, ways to reduce emissions or ways to help with climate change adaptation. And that's kind of a unique focus because we're one of the few funds that has, say, an equal focus on adaptation and mitigation. We feel strongly that the time to only focus on reducing emissions was 20 years ago. And now that we're living through the effects of climate change, we've got to find solutions that can help us adapt and thrive amidst our changing climate. And then we're early stage investors. We do seed and series A, and we're looking for software and simple hardware. So we're not taking on a lot of the tech risk that we did and that Evergreen does. And I learned a lot from running Evergreen. So that helped influence why I was focused on software as technology that can really help be an application layer on top of physical infrastructure and also stitch together all of these amazing hardware solutions. And so most of our companies are software companies, but in some cases they're using hardware, simple hardware like sensors, off-the-shelf hardware that they're using to collect unique data that is being used to help drive some kind of climate impact. And we're 100% female owned, and we have 6 people, and we did our final close the end of December, and we have $81 million under management.
All right. And has that female ownership translated into investments in female founders?
We do, yes. So we started out, we had 2 female founders. Now we have 1 company with a female founding team, and we are always on the lookout for female CEOs and founders. I think we pay a little extra attention when we find a company that's run by women, knowing that it's a little harder for women-led businesses to get venture dollars. But we care a lot about diversity in our founders. And so more than we have 9 investments so far in the fund, and more than half of them are either racially or gender diverse. And that is very equivalent to what we see in our pipeline. So of the 1,200 or so companies in our CRM, maybe it's more now, maybe more like 1,500, about half of those companies are gender or racially diverse founders and CEOs.
And do you want to say a bit about any of your investments? They're pertinent to this conversation about, we're going to get into electrification here. You have Audette, Canopy, then we are co-invested together, yay, in Benny. You've got Flood Flash and Storm Sensor and Shifted and Supply Shift. And anyway, you want to say just a bit about some of your companies?
Sure. I could talk about all of them. I love all of them. The first one, maybe I'll start with the first deal that we did when we were fundraising. We invested through, before we had a close of the fund, we invested through a special purpose vehicle, or an SPV as it's known, and put 6 investors into the Series A of Raptor Maps, and had a very bullish position on solar software because one of the most successful investments that I had in my track record from Energize was Aurora Solar. So knew how powerful software could be in servicing the solar industry in all different ways. And so Raptor Maps actually began life. They had 2 founders that met at MIT and spun out of MIT to create this company. They won the MIT Energy Prize. And they got started by taking drone footage that was captured by flying over large solar farms, utility scale solar farms, and analyzing all that video footage captured by the drones and returning reports to the owners, operators, and managers of those solar assets for ways to improve the output and production from the solar equipment. And so that's how they began life. And since then, they through their analysis and their recommendations, could improve the production by 2 to 3 percentage points, which is a meaningful amount for someone who's invested a lot of money in solar equipment.
And would that be things like shade or obstructions or soil buildup or that kind of thing?
Exactly. Cleaning. They would say, let's time to clean the panels, time to shade, trim the vegetation. But really importantly, they put thermal cameras on the drones and they could identify failures in the panels. And so then they could, recommend repairs that are necessary as well. If there was a storm, if there was a big storm event, they could fly the drones to go inspect damages, if there was a hailstorm or windstorm. That's how they began life. And since then, they've created multiple software solutions. And so they're selling now a software subscription service to a set of tools that helps people manage the operations and maintenance of the solar assets, and also keeps a digital record of all the performance and maintenance on that equipment, so that if there's ever a change of ownership or an insurance claim, they have good intelligence to inform the either valuation or the insurance claim. And one of the exciting areas that they're working on is as more robotics come into the drone space, basically, the ability to fly a drone that is a fully automated, remotely controlled robot on the site. Like nowadays, it's a drone pilot that goes out and sort of mans the flight of the site. Now they're using robots. They're starting to use robots to do that. But what that's doing is generating just an enormous amount of data about the site. And it makes it very easy and inexpensive to fly the site. So there's even greater need for somebody to take all that data and, you know, do something valuable with the data and help all of these folks that are managing the assets do something useful with the information. So that's a big theme across our portfolio, is using data to inform some kind of important business decision that either drives revenues and values or reduces costs or improves safety and things that are meaningful to the customers.
Got it. And then since we're going to talk about electrification here, you want to touch on Audette and Canopy?
Sure. So Audette is using artificial intelligence and other data sources and data science to inform the best way to decarbonize portfolios of commercial real estate. And so they kind of do the first level of analysis of a large number of buildings and then can give information to the managers of those buildings to help inform how they should go about reducing emissions and which buildings to begin with, which ones will have the greatest impact. And this is valuable when folks are trying to figure out where to spend money, you know, for the biggest return on their investment from an emissions reduction standpoint, or for a city that may have a pool of incentives that they're trying to distribute to building owners to drive some kind of emissions reductions in a city. They're sort of on the forefront of a number of our companies are using AI to artificial intelligence to do something valuable. So in this case, they've trained their models on all these different images of buildings and cities and data that they've gotten from publicly available sources on building stock and real estate to sort of make these recommendations and to make it very accessible to the building owners and building managers. But they're actually in Vancouver, outside Vancouver, and they're rolling out the US. And we led their seed round, which is really more, it's kind of like between a seed and an A. And Allison manages this investment for us. But they're doing great and they're getting a lot of great traction right now.
So they're essentially helping building owners to be more sustainable, have to make their buildings more sustainable, use less energy, use more clean energy, all that stuff.
Right. And they're not necessarily doing the audits or doing any of the, you're hearing a lot about the companies that are actually installing equipment and managing the audits and doing the energy management. They're not doing any of the kind of in-building. It's more at the portfolio level. So it's kind of a way to help folks that are trying to decide how to get, you know, reductions in emissions and energy consumption, like how to do that at sort of like a large scale.
Mm-hmm. And Canopy, that's on the residential side, right?
Canopy, yeah. So
yeah. So everyone listening, you know, wishes they had a greener home or wherever they're living. And so, talk about it.
We found Canopy when we were doing a scan of a number of companies that were offering solutions for employees of corporations that could, where they were looking for some way to utilize some level of financial stipend from the employer to drive home electrification or reduce one's home or personal emissions. So it could be a stipend that could be used to sort of improve the efficiency of your home, you know, or to purchase an electric vehicle. So it could also impact your transportation footprint and transportation emissions. And it was sort of this interesting kind of like employer-led way into home electrification.
So it's like a benefit, right? Like if you get
a
401k and this is your...
An FSA benefit.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
It was subsidized by the company that the company could subsidize the same thing.
Pretty cool.
And was a way to get at, you know, like all these businesses are making decarbonization pledges. And one of the things that we found was that there wasn't a ton of employee engagement in that, right? So they were making these decarbonization benefits or pledges rather, and they weren't necessarily thinking about, okay, how do we get all the employees involved in that? And how do we look at, you know, outside of the offices or the industrial operations or whatever, whoever the employer was, if people are now working from home, like they are working remotely, then we kind of need to look into their footprint as well if we're trying to... if we're trying to reduce emissions into our employee base. And so it's more than just kind of business travel, right? Or, you know, the electricity that you use when you're in the office, it's looking at, you know, well, if you're working from home 3 days a week, then there's some related emissions to your home footprint. So how could we reduce that?
It's almost like scope 2, scope 3 emissions from supply chain. But instead, so if you're an intellectual property company and you have only attorneys or software developers and no real manufacturing footprint or anything, then you know you got to green the houses they're living in, right? In order to to really meet your goals. Yeah. So that's a great segue, I'd say, to electrification. The focus of this conversation is always on mission as a competitive advantage, and we'll get to that. But this is also part of a series of conversations about electrification. And so I'd love it if you could say just a bit about, you know, what is electrification in your view, and the, you know, sort of the opportunity there for investors and for founders. And then we'll sort of get into software and the role of software in making that transition.
Sure. Well, we talked a little bit about home electrification, and there are a lot of companies that are looking at ways to help people electrify their homes with heat pumps and replacing, you know, gas stoves with induction stoves. But I think maybe worth talking about transportation, because that's an obvious big area we haven't touched on yet, and thinking about how to use software to drive some greater adoption of electric vehicles. And we're interested in sort of the fleet, the sort of medium and heavy duty vehicles, because they're, you know, first of all, the passenger vehicle, the sort of residential consumer passenger vehicle market is really, really fragmented. And there's a lot of exciting things happening there as folks are starting to purchase more and more EVs. But I think an untapped opportunity is in sort of fleet management. And with the Inflation Reduction Act, the need to deploy all of this charging infrastructure as managers of, you know, big industrial fleets are replacing their diesel-powered trucks or delivery vehicles with electric vehicles, they're going to need to charge them, usually at some kind of central depot. And that's going to require some upgrade to their supply in order to be able to do that. And there's right now, a lot of the utilities are trying to think about how do we properly size that upgrade, and you know, how quickly are these customers, their customers, these industrial customers, going to be able to purchase electric vehicles, because it's still really hard to get electric vehicles. So I think if the appetite is there, folks that are trying to utilize some of these great, you know, federal incentives are still, it's still hard to utilize them. So I think one way to address that is to help figure out, okay, with the pace of sort of change in the fleet, when do you need to upgrade the supply, and how does the utility need to consider doing that? It's kind of, there's a bottleneck now with utility to perform that analysis and to make that investment for the customer's sake. And there's a lot of efficiency that the customer can gain by charging off peak, you know, and trying to utilize energy when it isn't in great demand, so that the investments in the supply could be less than what they would be otherwise. But the other piece that we're very interested in is how do you solve that bottleneck for the utility? Because the utilities, you know, I think everybody's interests are aligned here, right? Like, you know, the big customers, the big industrial customers, commercial customers want to electrify to reduce their fuel costs and to reduce their carbon footprint. The utilities want to get all this load on the grid, right? Because that's their business. They want more load. And it's just hard to have the right engineers and analysts to sort of figure out how to do that, purchase the equipment, get it installed, and to sort of enable this transition right now. So it's similar to the way that there's a bottleneck when you hear about in sort of utility transmission, there's a bottleneck with the grid operators. There's a big queue of folks with wind and solar trying to get on the grid, and they have to go through this engineering study with the grid operator in order to be able to connect to the grid. And so we've looked at, there was a company that we saw a year or so ago that was had a software solution to help speed up that queue for utility scale power. But this is kind of like on a smaller scale, on an industrial scale for electric vehicles. And we're pretty intrigued with that investment space.
Yeah, interesting. And then let's talk just a little bit more about software there. So, you know, you described the conundrum with fleets where, you know, there are all thousands of vehicles from any given fleet coming online and needing to manage all that. Are there other places where you see software being applied in mobility? There's payments, multi-tenant buildings, there's
that's a big
ride
opportunity.
Share. Yeah.
Yeah. So a fleet could be, I was talking about industrial fleets, but a fleet could also be a fleet of, you know, rideshare drivers, right? So as Uber and Lyft are sort of making a transition to working with more and more EV drivers in their fleet, and there's more municipal incentives for them to do that, right? Because like a Chicago is a really great example where one way to reduce the emissions related to transportation in the city is to electrify the taxi fleet and the, you know, the rideshare fleet. And that's a big opportunity as well. But the charging for that is a little more complicated, right? Because folks are going and charging their vehicles, if they're an Uber driver, back at their homes. And if they live in a city, then they don't have great charging infrastructure available at their apartment building. That's a hard problem. It's like, how do you get more charging installed at multifamily homes? And then how do you make it even more cost effective to charge at your rental property? So if you don't own your property, that's another opportunity, is like figuring out how to make that a little bit easier. And we haven't taken that on as an investment thesis. I think there are some folks that have invested in that category, but I think it's a good one because you could have some pretty significant impact for sure. And then one other area that we're looking at that we're excited about is with trucks. So California has some rules now around the emissions and the compliance, the need to measure emissions at warehouses. And so where the trucks are coming to sort of either load up or drop off loads, and they're idling at these warehouses, they're creating a lot of pollution. And so California is trying to electrify, you know, broadly the vehicle fleet throughout the state, but they're targeting some of these areas because they're so dirty, they're so polluted. And so, you know, idling diesel trucks are really bad for the environment and for anybody that lives near any of these warehouses. So they're trying to figure out how to reduce the pollution around these locations, these hubs. And so there's probably some, we're looking at a company now that's using AI to try to reduce the idling time and to speed up the processing of the trucks that are coming to unload or reload their containers.
And if it's AI, it's somewhat obvious. It's a software company, right?
It's a software company, and they're using cameras and computer vision, you know, or like the way it's done now is speeding this up is done with RFID tags, but people are using now, this is a big theme across our portfolio, is using machine learning and you know, cameras and using, you know, image analysis to produce some kind of automated or, you know, more efficient way to process something. So in the case of this, it's sort of speeding up the processing of the trucks and reducing the idling time for the truck drivers. In other applications like Raptor Maps, it's taking images and using it to create some kind of efficiency in the equipment. We've got a land-based aquaculture company that is using cameras and AI and machine learning to automate the feeding of fish for production of salmon in big tanks on land instead of in the ocean. And so in that particular case, the cost of food is the largest cost of operating that facility. And so if you can optimize the feeding of the fish, you can reduce the cost of food, but you can also grow the fish faster because they actually grow a little faster if you feed them just the right amount as opposed to too much or too little.
And back to the charging in multi-tenant buildings. I'm guessing that's also a software problem primarily because, you know, we have the charging infrastructure to put in these buildings. It is a challenge, but you know, many of them have them. But like right now, I'm renting an apartment because our house is you know, doing some renovation, and we have a parking spot. But when if I want to use one of the chargers in the lot, and you know, overnight, once it's done charging, I'm going to get all sorts of you know, extra charges because I didn't take if I don't take the you know, the adapter off the car because someone else needs to use it, right? But then I don't want to wake up in the middle of the night and go take that thing off. Also, I don't want to get home from work and find out that they're all full, right? So like scheduling and you know, managing all of this sounds like a software problem to me.
Yeah, it's like reservations. It's like OpenTable for restaurants, right? But it's like OpenTable, but for charging infrastructure. You know, somebody's got to have a schedule, and you know, and then you've got to understand like, okay, based upon who's coming in and what amount of time they need to charge, you know, what's their slot going to be and how do you do that? And then there's always pricing, you know, getting into sort of pricing efficiency and sort of sensitivity, like trying to take advantage of lower prices when, of course, they're you know, in the evening when like, you know, there's less demand once folks are overnight sleeping, like how do you, you know, put, everybody's going to try to figure out how to do it most cheaply as well. So that's certainly a case for an industrial operator, but that will become, I think, for sure an issue as well for passenger vehicles.
Yeah. All right, let's turn a bit to buildings. We've covered that with Audette and Canopy in a way that that's commercial and residential. And we can move on to other areas. But do you see other exciting, is there another box or two you want to check in buildings?
Sure.
You know, HVAC and maybe green, we looked at a green material, like a building material supply marketplace company. There are all sorts of interesting things out there. I guess that's not electrification, but you get the idea.
Yeah. So we invested in a company called Shifted Energy, and was started in Hawaii, and they are shifting the load for electric water heaters to when renewables are more available or when prices are cheaper.
Uh-huh. Almost like a battery.
Exactly. So you can heat the water ahead of time when people need it, and maybe a little bit off peak, and then they're really trying to make it sensitive to when people are actually using the water, right? So whether it's to do dishes or shower, like optimizing it to the behavior patterns of the individuals. And in this case, Hawaii is a really great test market because electricity prices are so high and they have a very high penetration of renewables. But most homeowners don't have a way to take advantage of that, especially if they're living in apartment buildings, right? So they can't necessarily generate solar power because they're in some kind of multifamily dwelling. And so this company was actually designed to help folks, especially lower middle income folks, to take advantage of renewable energy. And so they're rolling out into the mainland now, US, to the western states, California, Colorado, as well as some of the eastern and southeastern states. And they're going to be moving from water heaters to electric vehicles. So the same technology around this optimization for water heaters can be applied to electric vehicles as well. So I think it's a way for folks to use software when you can't necessarily make these investments. In their case, that you have to have an electric water heater. So like, for instance, our water heater here is gas powered, but for folks that have electric water heaters, you can do this kind of manipulation. And it sometimes requires a device. At other times it has equipment that, if it's a newer water heater, it has been installed with the equipment that allows this control of the device. But that's, you know, demand response and, you know, energy, trying to make like the home is a little virtual power plant. But usually it's demand response management. And I think that there's a lot of companies that are doing this in unique ways with thermostats, you know, with, as I said, sort of refrigerators, stoves, and other big appliances. In this case, they're just focused on water heaters as their first point of entry.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, anything else in buildings that you see as low-hanging fruit in terms of electrification specifically? Otherwise, we'll move on to industry.
Well, I think that, you know, Aurora Solar, as I understand it, is doing well, but there's still a lot of innovation with software in the residential and rooftop solar market still to come, because we have a lot of roofs, whether they're homes or commercial buildings or industrial buildings, and back to warehouses. Like, think of all the warehouses with these big flat roofs, right, that you could put solar power on and create sort of mini microgrids for these bigger customers. I think that's a really exciting space. So we're seeing a number of companies that are coming forward with microgrid solutions that could help figure out the pricing based upon, you know, variable pricing, as well as on-site supply of solar power and some storage, like how to make this as sort of clean as possible for the customer, as well as reducing their ongoing energy costs. And I think that's a good time to see some of that innovation come to market and to see sort of how that can play out for some of these bigger customers. So I just mentioned, you know, shifting on a small scale, this is happening, but on a larger scale, I think there's a lot of great opportunity to deploy renewable energy storage and then managing the load to when prices are cheaper or, you know, greener.
Yep. And that's a great segue to industry, because you mentioned like commercial buildings with a microgrid. And, you know, if it's a large plant, you know, manufacturing facility or something, some, you know, heavy industry making steel or whatever, you know, similar thing. And I think many of them have like on-site cogeneration facilities where they're burning, you know, fossil fuels or plant matter, or whatever, and producing their own energy, right? And or buying it from the grid. And if the grid goes down or prices spike, you know, they're sort of subject to that. So they want more steady supply. They want more predictable prices. They want, you know, resilience. you want to say a bit about what you see happening in industry?
Yeah, I think you know, you did a great summary, Rick, of, you know, what I think the opportunity space is. I think, you know, crypto mining is an obvious, you know, giant energy load, right? You've seen some of the graphs on how much energy, you know, crypto mining requires. It's enormous. So how could you make that supply of energy greener, also create some storage and resiliency? But I think as AI grows, you know, it's going to take a lot of computing power for all of these AI models to be run. So similar to crypto and the energy profile of the crypto industry, the growing computing power required to power the ChatGPT and all these large language models, it's going to be very similar, where there's going to be a lot of data centers and servers that are needed to do all these calculations and to run these models. And so I think there's a growing opportunity to supply those operations with clean energy, some amount of on-site energy to take some of the strain off the grid. You know, they all need to have grid connectivity for resiliency and sort of certainty of power supply, but then doing some level of on-site power and storage so that in an outage, they have some sort of, you know, at least a day or two's worth of storage to be able to run their operations. So there's going to be a big opportunity, you know, without going, you know, pivoting a little bit differently. You asked about industrial, but I think about this as sort of like industrial data. You know, that's to me like a big, big opportunity. And most in the Chicago area, I remember hearing recently, and I'm sure this is very similar still, but like, I don't know, like 7 or 8 or 10 of our local utilities' top customers were all data businesses because they require so much power. So,
interesting. So when you're talking about, it's the new heavy industry.
Exactly.
Processing
it's the new energy
electrons.
Intensive industry.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Yeah. And now that industry is in managing data centers and all that is as old as time. But you're talking about attaching clean energy to these things, using energy storage on site to shift the pricing and the loads and smooth the loads and avoid demand charges and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, and the big tech companies are big purchasers of renewable energy, right? So Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, Apple all have really, really massive programs to procure clean energy. And, you know, for the most part, they're doing this with large-scale power purchase agreements. But I know that they're also looking at doing some of this with on-site as well to try to do all of what you just described, you know, create advantages for their operations. And no, I think it's an exciting time, and they've been kind of leading the way. And some of the slower to digitize, we just finished some research. So one of the things Buoyant does is we do deep dives in our different industry segments. And climate touches every industry. So we're investing across energy, mobility, the built environment, as we've already talked about, agriculture, water, circular economy. And we just finished some research with some MBA students at Columbia University on digital applications for industrial emission reductions. And looking for ways to sort of do a lot of what we're just describing, which is kind of run the operations more efficiently, ways to deploy energy more strategically on site, microgrids and other solutions for managing and making the power supply more, not only cleaner, but more resilient and replacing some of the fossil related generation cogen that you've described. So I think it's been one of the areas that's probably been underinvested. And like, even when we think of industrial operations like steel and cement, most of the innovation has been around the material itself, you know, so trying to reduce the emissions of the actual material, but you can take a look at the operations of the plant, the physical plant, the manufacturing plant, to try to reduce the energy, the scope 2 emissions in that case, right? So the scope 2 emissions related to the consumption of energy for their operations. There's a lot of opportunities there.
How about heating? I've been looking for things in industrial, you know, applications of electrification, and it's a little frustrating. But one of the things that keeps coming up is heating, like not the kind of heating like for an apartment building, but for, you know, if you're going to make steel, you need a tremendous amount of heat to melt iron ore and mix it and whatnot. If you're making cement, same thing, you need tons of heat. And then at the same time, you're making all this heat, you're wasting a bunch of heat. So has that been something that's come up? And do you have a view on that?
We don't have a view on that. I know what you're talking about. So like recycling of heat, mm-hmm. and
district,
capturing,
I think they call it district energy or something, where they sort of like a heat pump, but for big industrial heat. Yeah.
No, I think it's a great opportunity, and in making that cost effective has been, I know when we looked at this, there was a few companies that were doing this that we looked at when I was running the Clean Energy Trust, but we haven't looked at it so much because it's usually involving some kind of industrial process to do that. And that would fall a little bit outside of scope for us for Buoyant.
Yep. Got it. Okay. Let's shift gears for a sec. Unless, is there anything else you want to say on industry, but I want to shift to mission as a competitive advantage.
No, I think the only thing we didn't really cover was circular economy. So this like reuse, right? So resource efficiency is a good space to think about, whether it's ag waste and trying to get some value out of waste streams. So like this is the space of, you know, there's industrial waste streams, there's agricultural waste streams, there's consumer waste streams, and sort of how can we try to figure out how to turn that waste into something valuable? And in some cases, it's just maybe reducing the production of the waste. And that's a little bit of what Benny's trying to do, right? So the clothing company, the software for sort of secondhand clothing shopping that we're mutual investors in, they're trying to use software to expand the market for secondhand clothing shopping so that less clothing is wasted, because most of the fast fashion, a lot of the fashion, even that the clothes that are donated, well, first of all, most of it goes into landfill and goes into garbage, sadly. The clothes that are donated, a very, very small percentage actually gets reused. The rest of it goes into landfill or gets sent overseas. And that ends up being a garbage problem for developing countries. And so Benny's mission is to try to reduce the amount of new clothing that's bought and focus people's money on items that have higher resale value so that they have a longer life. So that's why we really like them. It fit our thesis around reducing emissions related to the fashion industry and the textile industry. But that's a good example of how software could be meaningful. If just more people can purchase a used item, that will help reduce the amount of waste personally that they're generating from fashion. And it's a very complementary way that folks are, you know, looking right now with textiles to make textiles more easily to recycle, to reduce the sort of environmental toxicity of dyes and other chemicals that go into clothing production. But this is sort of a software way to attack that. So I think circular economy, there's a lot of, you know, we saw a couple of companies in the sort of AI space for industrial recycling and trying to use AI to speed up the efficiency and processing of recycling items. And so you've heard of AMP Robotics, which is doing it with robotics, but there's folks that are using cameras and other sort of AI solutions to try to improve the production and efficiency of these recycling centers. So I think there's a great opportunity in that space as well.
That's really cool stuff. I was looking at one of those companies and went to a recycling center, and it's a lot of people standing around, I mean, currently sifting through the conveyor belt going by, you know, picking things off and putting all the clamshells or whatever over here and the soda bottles over there. And then you've got these big robotic machines with like vacuum suction tentacles on them, just doing something similar, but for something that has been like a really hard problem to solve in the past. Really cool stuff. Have you guys invested in that or are you,
yeah? No, we aren't, but we'd like to have something. And we looked at a company that was using software and cameras to do that. And we didn't get there, but they did get funded, which we're excited to follow their progress. But you know, when you hear about like what only 9% of all the plastics in the world gets recycled, so all of that plastic waste is going into landfill or ending up in the ocean, right? So how could you improve that? You know, like making that percentage of waste more valuable and recyclable, I think is a great goal to have. And so, you know, folks are looking at composting, right? We've heard about Mill as sort of a consumer composting solution, but I think in the industrial sort of like the large scale recycling, like trying to improve the operations there or make the separation of those waste streams more efficient, I think is a great area for innovation.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. And it's just cool too. I mean, seeing these like high speed octopuses grabbing stuff is really fun.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about mission. So I guess I'm curious to know, do you identify as a mission driven investor? Would you put a nuance on that or what? And then after that, I have questions about like how that may or may not manifest in your work.
Sure. Well, we definitely consider ourselves to be mission-driven because of our focus on climate. So as I said, nothing would make it into our deal pipeline if we couldn't figure out how that solution could have meaningful emission reductions or climate adaptation impact. But then we're looking for financial return for our investors. So that's just the screen at the top, because we promised our investors that that's kind of our high level filter on all of our companies. So, and we've made a very conscious decision. While there can be very strong emission reductions in the oil and gas industry, we've decided not to invest in that space. So like some folks are making some really great investments in that space to reduce methane flaring and emissions to improve the safety and security of pipelines. And that's actually a great application for software too,
for
right?
Sure. Yep.
It's been our, what we decided, what we told our investors is that we didn't want to feel compromised for any of those companies to service the oil and gas industry where their solutions would be enabling the continued profitability and life of the fossil fuel industry or to be, you know, subjects of greenwashing, right? We wanted this to be like, wanted our sort of intent to be sort of purely focused on climate and technologies that were going to really attack climate change that didn't have a focus on oil and gas customers. So nothing against the oil and gas industry. Again, there could be tremendous emission reductions there. We're just not investing in that space. But I think we do have a really clear, you know, mission focus to our fund. And I think it's really an advantage because it gives us clarity and it helps us sort through the deals and it helps us refine our strategy so that when we find something that has both the impact that we want and then has the financial benefit that we want, I think we're feeling like we're delivering really great value to our investors because they're getting more than the financial benefit. They're also getting what we hope will be in the end of a very measurable, tangible climate benefit to their investment dollars. So I think there's a very strong interest from the LP, the investor community, the limited partner, institutional investor, and family office market for delivering that kind of impact with their dollars. And I think you have to have authenticity around that. You know, I think a lot of folks have cropped up. I mean, you guys have been around for a while. You've been very focused on this from the very beginning. So I think no one could question what your focus is, but there certainly have been funds, generalist funds and others that have tried to maybe like bolt this onto their strategy. And I think it has been an advantage for us that it's very core to our thesis and our identity.
And then talk about the advantage. So like one obvious one would be sourcing deals and winning over founders. You know, do you think that it helps you win an investment that might be, you know, highly desirable and lots of investors circling around and you're able to sort of play your, you know, multi-decade credibility and dedication to climate to sort of woo the founders?
Yeah, I think it goes back to authenticity. You know, when you talk to them and you understand what they're trying to do and how well it fits with what our objectives are, I think that that alignment becomes, I think, you know, very tangible. And I think the other thing is the expertise, like understanding what they're doing is really important. I can't tell you how many times we've talked to companies and they're like, we're so glad we don't have to explain this to you guys,
right.
You know, because maybe they're talking to a broad set of investors and those broad set of investors like don't understand what parametric flood insurance is. It's like, no, that's our specialty. Like we actually did a whole deep dive on this. And so when we found this company and we picked this flood insurance company, Flood Flash, it was after doing some very thoughtful research that one of our team members, Jacob Gleason, led on climate risk intelligence. And it led us to solutions that could properly price climate risk. And one of the insurance solutions or the types of insurance that can do that, we thought more effectively than traditional insurance was parametric insurance. And in this case, it was insurance that was tied to flood depth, not to property damages, as a means of pricing risk more affordably and offering solution for customers of flood insurance who maybe have had floods and can't get flood insurance or where the flood insurance is just too expensive. And so I remember when we talked to them, they're like, wow, okay, like, I'm so glad we don't have to explain this to you. It's like, no, we've done our homework. You know, we've done our homework. Yep. We understand. But I think other times, like just, I think that the founders are looking for someone as from an investor who is just, is very long-term, you know, focused on long-term results, right? So they, I mean, obviously we have a 10-year life to our fund and we're trying to get money back for our investors before that time frame is, before that that timeline is up. But I think having a long view on what we're all trying to do, I think helps a founder feel like we're going to be sympathetic to some of the decisions that they're going to make along the way for their business and, you know, what's really driving them and how to recruit people to the company, you know, like how to, we could help source talent that wants to who believes in that mission and who may be coming into the climate space from other industries because they want more purpose in their work and they want to feel like they're doing something good and they've maybe been laid off or they've worked a few jobs that they haven't felt like that, or it's just been for the money or the paycheck. And that at the end of the day is not as motivating. And so they're looking for something beyond the paycheck to believe in. And I think if you are an investor who has that same mindset, I think the founders and the CEOs feel like you get them, you know, and that you're going to sort of be a good steward of the company and you're going to be helpful at the board level because you're going to be interested in more than just making money. You're going to be helping to guide them with the proper, you know, like we care a lot about diversity and inclusion, right? So all of our companies that we invest in make a commitment to implement a diversity and inclusion policy and to measure DE&I in their business on a quarterly basis. And just doing that helps them, I think, be more attractive to a wide assortment of talent.
Yeah, agreed. And so that's a great pathway to gender. You are a Buoyant is a very rare all-female GP firm. And not only are women, of course, underrepresented in tech broadly as founders and as investors, but in particular at the upper ranks of the investor world. And so here you two are rainmakers running your firm. Would you say that that has its advantages as well?
I'd like to say it was a real advantage when we were fundraising, but I have to tell you, Rick, I don't want to be a downer, but there were so many people who said, we want to invest in like diverse managers and female-led managers. And like the people that said that versus the people that do it, like there weren't that many people that did it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was almost like they gave lip service to it.
So back to your authenticity comment.
Right. Back to the authenticity. It's like I think the investors were getting pressure to diversify their managers. So they said that and they were reacting to that. But I think when it came down to it, that maybe their models for evaluating investment were still very much rooted in traditional and historicals. And, you know, new funds, very focused, thematically focused funds and emerging managers are typically been the outperformers in the venture space, right? That these kinds of managers do very well. And the sort of drive that it takes to launch a new fund and then the specific expertise and focus that one has around a certain investment thesis can usually yield better results because you can be very, very disciplined. And it's easier to communicate, I think, to the portfolio companies what you're about, you know, so you can sort of find the right companies to sort of invest in and you can be very, very clear with what you're looking for. But I think in terms of just, you know, being women, I think it has definitely helped us. We, you know, like I said, half of our pipeline of founders and CEOs are racially or gender diverse. And so I think being two women probably gives us some, communicate something to that audience of entrepreneurs that we're serious about it. But we care a lot too about, you know, supporting the development of talent in the industry. And there's so much wonderful young talent coming in. And I will tell you, it is, if anything, it's maybe more women than men. Like I don't have data exactly on who's applied for all of our internships, but I have to tell you, it's almost been, if it's not more, it's certainly equal, women to men that apply for our fellowships. So we run throughout the year, all throughout the school year in the summer, an MBA fellows program. And we hired both Jacob and Laura as sort of graduates of that program, two team members. And we have a wonderful MBA fellow who's graduating from Kellogg named Katie Clayson, who did some terrific work for us this past year. And she did a bunch of work on Benny. She helped on the diligence of Benny. She was a real advocate for that deal because it was started by two of the founders. One of the founders and one of the executives were at the Kellogg, Northwestern's Kellogg MBA program that Katie went through. And Katie's going to go on. She's got a great job offer at Prelude, so she'll be still working in the industry. But we do this knowing that these folks, if we can help give them a good experience and teach them something about climate venture, you know, even if we can't hire them, which usually we can't because we're working with sort of three or four people throughout the year, then we can launch them into a career. And then we'll have friends, more friends at all these firms. So maybe one of them will co-join you guys at Better
Agreed,
Ventures,
yes,
you know, Rick,
perhaps.
And then we'll have another friend over there. So
there we go.
But we take that very seriously, like trying to develop all this talent. I always say young people are going to save us because I feel like, you know, they have the most to lose in this climate change crisis that's happening, and they're highly motivated and they're sort of living their values now, and they're entering the space at a much greater rate. And there's all these terrific programs, these, you know, college programs, undergraduate programs, graduate programs that are producing this talent, which has amazing, you know, skills and knowledge to bring, much, much more than when, you know, I was entering the space. Like, we didn't have these very specialized dual MBA, Masters of Sustainability programs at these top schools. So, but these kids are amazing. They're amazing. They're smart. They're driven. They're ambitious. They're urgent, which is really fantastic.
Agreed. So let's see, before we transition to my favorite question, your personal mission, would you have any advice for female founders, aspiring female investors, women in tech generally, for how to be successful? I mean, you've had a storied career and you're now sitting in a very powerful seat. What advice would you have for those who are maybe just starting out?
I think if you're a founder, like, definitely talk, there's those, even though only 2% of all the capital in the venture space is managed by, wait, is it 5% managed by female partners and 2% founders that are women that get it? In any case, it's a very, very
small. It's really
small,
low.
Right?
It's so way like, too, it's not 50 yeah, or really 51. Low. And that's the problem.
It's below 5. Yeah. It's below 5%. That I say, you know, there's more funds that have been started by women in the last couple of years. Like, I would totally recommend you find a female funder to back you. I think that is a great start. And if you're putting together a seed round, like, try to find some female investors. And we know a bunch of them, you know, that in addition to us, there's Voyager, there's Powerhouse, there's, you have Lindsay on your team. Yep. She's fantastic.
Rethink
I'm super
Impact,
excited to be in Benny
one
with
of
her.
Our friends.
Yeah.
Urban Innovation.
Yeah. No, yeah, they're totally right. They've got a great portfolio, great fund. And yes, it's wonderful. Female investors. So find some female investors. I think that's great because I think they will be highly motivated to sort of hear your story and want to help you and highly sympathetic. And then I think if you're starting out in the venture space, I would guess I would have the same advice. Although I'm noticing, as you said, a lot of funds that are run by men are hiring women at the lower level. And I think it, you know, to Katie's example, like, she's got, you know, and there's another really talented woman, Eliza, that came through Columbia that worked with us, and she had good offers from good firms. And so I think there's a real interest in hiring these junior women in, but then I would put the challenge out to the heads of those funds to develop these women, you know, give them a path to real growth, because otherwise they're going to leave and they're going to go somewhere else. If you can't kind of keep them. So I think we have to watch really carefully to see, okay, how many women are being hired at the associate level, at the principal level, and then how many are actually making their way to partner level. Because that is, I think, you know, if they aren't, then I think there's enough other women-led funds that are getting started that they will find their way out of those firms into sort of other firms that are growing. But I hope that they could stay and be successful at the funds that they're at, because that's how they're going to create wealth, you know, like when they've vested their carry. And, you know, there's some excellent, excellent funds in our space that have mostly male senior partners. Would love to see them bring more women up the ranks there too. You know, I think that's really necessary.
Agreed. Okay. So we're ready to wrap things up here. We asked this question of everyone. Love to hear your answer, which is, if you were to summarize your personal mission, Amy, in a line or so, what would that be? Amy is on a mission to what?
Make the world a better place in the short amount of time I have left, with a focus on, you know, helping to solve climate change. I'm a mom. I have you know, two kids. I care a lot about the next generation. I draw a lot of inspiration from young people, and I just want, you know, I feel like we've given these young people a raw deal and we haven't been paying enough attention to what the world is becoming from an environmental standpoint. And so we have to do a better job. So my purpose is to make my contribution, you know, to make it measurably better before I'm gone.
Amy Francetic, managing general partner and co-founder of Buoyant Ventures, on a mission to make the world a better place in a short amount of time. Great talking with you, Amy.
Rick, thank you so much for the opportunity and love what you guys are doing at Better Ventures. And thank you for the chance to talk about what we're doing and what we're seeing. And I hope we can do more investments together.
Yeah, likewise. Let's find some more investments.
Thanks for listening to Mission Driven. To find out more about Better Ventures, visit us at better.vc or on Twitter @BetterVentures.